Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Coach's Corner. I'm Coach Andrew Poretz from Ingenuity Coaching. I help people to discover and fulfill their passions and greatness. My mission is to inspire and challenge you to dream big dreams, and with my coaching, help you to manifest those dreams into reality. You can visit my website at myfuturecoach.com and follow me on Twitter at Coach Andrew. If you're listening live and you have a question, the phone number here is 646-929-2893. Again, that's 646-929-2893. You'll be able to listen to the show on the phone, and if you press the number 1, I will know you have a question. There's also a live chat room right on the show page where you can feel free to join in and ask questions. Now, this is my first Coach's Corner in just about a year. I've come out of my seeming temporary retirement to interview a really cool guy I met last year, Stephen J. Griffel. Now, Stephen J. Griffel has a distinguished career as an editor, publisher, and writer in the educational publishing field, and he's authored several books in his acclaimed David Grossman series, including his most recent book, Grandview, which I recently had the pleasure of reading on my Kindle app on my phone. Now, you can find out more about Stephen at Amazon, but I'd like to know, Stephen, are you on the phone with me right now?
I am here, Andrew.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Andrew.
Great to have you here on my show.
Thank you. I'm proud to be here.
As you should be. So, so where are you calling in from right now?
Well, at the moment, I live in Bayside, Queens, just in the shadow of the Frog's Neck Bridge.
Very nice. Well, I grew up in Bayside, Queens, in the shadow of, not quite in the shadow of the Frog's Neck Bridge, but I grew up in the Bay Terrace area, went to public school, PS 169, and Bell Boulevard was my boulevard.
I know it well. My children both went to that school, PS-169.
But I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to know that you're really a Bronx boy at heart.
I am a Bronx boy. I'm actually a second-generation Jew. My ancestors came from Poland, from Russia, from Galicia. Perhaps some came from somewhere beyond the Pale. I don't know for sure.
Or somewhere beyond the sea.
These are all exotic places, and I have never visited them and likely never will.
Oh, well, you know, we apparently have a lot in common. My grandparents came from, they called it Russia-Poland.
Yes.
And today it's called Lithuania. So that's like my part of the world.
Indeed, so, yes.
So, Stephen, you are an unusual. I have you listed as a ebook author because your books are basically not the kind of books that you would go into the Barnes and Noble, if they still have such a thing, and pick up a nice copy. But you actually will buy your book and download it. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. You know, quite frankly, when I first was published, that was about half a dozen years ago, mm-hmm. I was considered something of a digital pioneer. Mm. Although ebooks had been around for the better part of, you know, 20 or 30 years, in most cases, writers had published through the traditional paper-bound paradigm, and once in a while an ebook would have been released. But in my case, I was published by a publisher who maintains a digital rights only platform, and that was highly unusual. In fact, when I was first published, there was no Kindle for Macintosh.
Mm-hmm.
It was not easy to get the book. There were no tablets, there were no smartphones, and very few people were aware of what a digital book was. So it was a tough road for me to beat the pavement and educate people and try to convince them to read digital books.
And did you ever, consider trying another means or expanding that outside of that digital, or has that always been the plan?
Oh, it absolutely was not always the plan. In fact, it wasn't even imagined. I grew up in the traditional publishing world. I worked, actually, and continue to work in publishing. I've been doing that for nearly 42 years and had always dreamt of writing and publishing the great American novel the way that people have been dreaming about that for the last 150 years. With my beautifully bound books in the large windows of big, beautiful bookstores, it just didn't happen that way for me. I published many things over the course of the years, stories, poetry, magazine articles, books for children, but I had never published the big novel. It just happened when I finally found a publisher who loved my work. He was on a digital rights only. And that was something that really was difficult for me to get used to. But I have come not only to endorse it, I've really come to embrace that phenomenon. I really do love digital books and the whole phenomenon at this point.
Yeah, I want to get a little clarity here. So you say digital rights only. So where are the other rights?
Well, in other words, my publisher does not have the means or the interest even in publishing a paper-bound book. It would be suicide for most of the new indie publishers to go in that direction. There's just no profit to be made. Now, however, if the book were to get hot enough, my publisher would make inquiries, and quite frankly, he already has.
Oh, okay.
The first book, 40 Years Later, has done really well. It has sold over 50,000 copies.
Wow.
And that in itself was enough buzz for him to pick up the phone and talk to publishers, and those conversations are actually ongoing to some degree. It hasn't happened yet. It certainly may. In the very beginning, I really was rooting, dare I say, praying that it would happen.
Uh-huh.
But I've let that go. I'm really comfortable with the being only on a digital platform. I lose some readers, as you can imagine. There are people who simply refuse to read a book in a digital format, but I gain so many. All around the world, too. I mean, that's the thing. So many people have computers or tablets or cell phones, and I get messages on Facebook and through email from readers all around the world, and it's incredibly, incredibly thrilling for me.
What is the most unusual kind of contact you've gotten from somebody who has found your book?
I think it's the island of Pago Pago. I think it's a truck stop away between New Zealand and Australia. I'm not sure, but my publisher is able to track all of the sales, and although the great majority of sales have been in the United States, we have sold all around the world. In fact, several years ago, my publisher sent me a note. Actually, he called me to tell me this. He said, "Congratulations, Stephen. Your books have now been sold on 6 continents." And I was amazed. I was thrilled. I danced a little jig. I yelled out to my wife, who was in the next room. I said, "Honey, did you know my books were selling on 6 continents?" And she yelled back, "Aren't there 7? Tough critic.
Ingrate. yeah, there's always that little bit more, right?
we keep the bar raised very high around here.
Yeah. So I want to get back a little bit to your background, like your story. How did you spent a lot of time in different end of publishing, not in the novel form. And how did you go from there to here? Or was that something you always were working on?
Huh. Well, good question. I'm wondering if I should back up into some earlier even inspiration, or do you want me
Absolutely.
To go?
Absolutely. No, no. Yeah. We love inspiration here on Coach's Corner.
Okay, then I've got some of my own here. I guess the best way to describe my history is I was a good student, not a great student. I was a good ball player, not a great ball player. In fact, there wasn't anything that particularly distinguished me.
Mm.
But growing up, I was always good at telling jokes and stories. And it seemed, because I was so good at this talking, this storytelling, it seemed to give me a little niche, a little place in the world that set me apart as something a little bit special. Anyway, when I was still a pretty young boy, I think I was about 13 years old, and it was the summer before high school.
Right.
And I had been accepted into the scholarship program at DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx in New York City. And that high school had the scholarship class had a very rigorous English program. And they were preparing me ahead of time to be introduced to two classes of English a day, one class in composition, one class in literature. And as part of this preparation, they gave me a reading list for this summer before I entered high school. And I don't remember the exact number of the books. Maybe there were like 10 books, and I was required to choose 7 or 8 of them. And the list included classic heavyweights like Jack London, Louis Stevenson, Rudyard Kipling, Arthur Conan Doyle, that kind of stuff. Looking at such a list now, it's not much of a gender-balanced or multicultural list. But even so, it was a great list. And when I first got the list, quite frankly, I was crushed. I didn't want to read these books. I just wanted to have a summer vacation. I think I started to cry because I was imagining everyone else having fun during the summer, and I was going to be stuck inside reading the books. But I did read them. And that summer that I thought would be seriously damaged, possibly ruined by having to read so many books, that summer and reading those books were a turning point in my life. When I read them, and they were all of them great books, and I read them one after the other, they gave me a critical mass of motivation to read more. And it set for me, it established for me a habit of reading and reading great literature. And not long after that, it occurred to me, because I was enjoying the experience so much, that I might be a writer, maybe even a great one. Hey, we dream big.
Sure, why not?
We dream big. And so I started to fuss around and write my stories and write my poetry. And, you know, a couple of years passed, and I went to college. And I was a freshman at 16, and I already knew exactly what I wanted to do. I chose Queens College because at the time it was the best school in the city university system, and also because they were renowned for the English department, which was so varied, Andrew, it actually had an entire separate department for creative writing and its own degree.
Well, by the way, what years were you at Queens College?
1969 was my freshman year, and I graduated 4 years later in 73.
So were you there when Jerry Seinfeld was there?
I don't remember, Jerry. I do remember that not long before me, there was much talk of Paul Simon.
Paul Simon went there? I did not know
that. Yes, Paul Simon was at Queens College, and his friend Art Garfunkel was at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And they were Paul was at Queens College a couple years before I was there.
I know a famous short, rotund male porno star went there by the name of Ron Jeremy. I know Ron Jeremy.
Oh, I know. Ron Jeremy's still around. Maybe I shouldn't admit that so readily. I know Ron Jeremy. Oops.
Oh. Oops. Well, now we know.
Anyway,
only here in Coach's
Corner
do we find this out.
So I declared my major. At 16,
yeah.
I said, I'm going to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I took my degree in creative writing, and I prepared myself for a career. As soon as I finished Queens College, I then entered Fordham University, and I took a master's degree in American literature. I wasn't a scholar. I mean, I really did not care even very much about scholarship per se,
mm-hmm.
but I was still very young. Even in graduate school, I was barely out of my teens, maybe I just turned 20, and I just didn't feel like I was ready to write big books yet. So it occurred to me that the next best thing would be to stay in school a while longer and read the great books by other great American writers and try to learn a little bit.
And do you remember any of the things you read that stuck with you, made an influence on you?
Oh, yeah. I was very influenced by Bernard Malamud.
Mm-hmm.
I was, I think, actually the four biggest influences, not necessarily my favorite books, but the four biggest influences were William Faulkner.
Mm.
Faulkner taught me how to really appreciate my past and my culture. Franz Kafka. And Kafka taught me how to really think about my dreams and to see the story content of my dreams and the possibilities of story from my dreams.
Did he also teach you to think about your nightmares?
Well, yeah, they're pretty dire dreams for sure. And then there were two others. There was a writer named Lawrence Durrell, and he's very famous for having created this amazing masterpiece called the Alexandria Quartet. It actually is a quartet, a tetralogy, four books.
Ah,
and
okay.
What he does with perspective in that novel, telling the same story from four different perspectives, really shook me to my core.
Mm.
And I was never the same after reading Lawrence Durrell's work. And there was a French writer named Alain Robbe-Grillet. And Robbe-Grillet, a little bit like Durrell, was famous for really doing experimental work with the narrative form. I mean, he would fracture it. He would almost atomize it into impressions, pull it all together again. I was incredibly interested not only in usual kind of literal or sequential narrative,
mm-hmm.
but I was really interested in the protean qualities of the novel. I mean, it was an amazing form. You could ask it to do anything. It could bend in any direction like Gumby. And it was just an amazing vehicle. And so for years, I studied the architecture or the architectural possibilities of novel writing. Eventually, I kind of left all that.
Right.
And that was sort of stuff from my youth in my graduate school days. But in fact, I'm not a very big experimenter in my own fiction, with a few exceptions.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, all of my novels, in fact, as you know, they are known collectively as the David Grossman series. Mm-hmm. And what explains that is that all three of the novels, and those being Grandview, 40 Years Later, and The Deadline, each of those novels share a first-person narrator, named David Grossman.
Right.
But all of those novels pretty much move along in a traditional sequential narrative way. The very first book that was published, though, 40 years later, I took some unusual chances. And I didn't start out thinking I'm going to take some unusual chances. It was just very organic. It just happened that way.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened in 40 years later is that much of the book is actually told via the exchange of emails.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and that in itself is not all that new, because novels have been written, you know, for many years, through letter writing.
Right, sure.
In fact, Dracula is such a novel as that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but writing them through emails was very modern, and it caught a lot of people's attention, and that was a fun thing to do. But I'm still pretty much of a traditionalist with my own narrative form, and I guess what still sets me apart is the digital thing.
Sure.
Although at this point, it's become pretty common.
Right.
I don't get asked a whole lot of questions anymore. You know, what's a digital book? What's an e-book? You know, when I first started, I was asked to speak. I don't really recollect how it came about, but I was asked to speak at the famous New York Public Library branch at Soho, which is famous for its reading series. I was not part of their formal reading series, but somehow mm-hmm. they had heard of me and my story and my book, which was 40 years later, and they invited me to speak. It appears that it went extremely well, because about 3 days later, I got an email, and the subject of the email line was Senior Librarian of New York City.
Mm.
So I double click. I read. I think I'm being punked, because it's such, an unusual thing. And what it was is the senior librarian of New York City from the 42nd Street Library had heard of my presentation from the head librarian of the Soho branch, and invited me to reprise my presentation at 42nd Street. So I went from complete anonymity to being a little bit well known.
Wow.
In about 72 hours.
Well, that doesn't sound like such a bad thing.
No, it was wonderful. And quite frankly, after that, I had only to present the information about my experience at 42nd Street, and I was getting invitations to speak at all kinds of places, other kinds of libraries and community centers, and et cetera.
Right. Now you're saying that people are now pretty, you know, not surprised by e-books and all this technology, but you know, a lot of people, it's still a fairly new thing.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was turned down the other day. I reached out to a friend who is a member of the Jewish organization of Hadassah.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that she was a member of this chapter's book club. And so I asked her if she would inquire among her sisterhood if they might be interested in reading one of my books. And they seemed to be very interested until they found out that it was a digital book. This particular sisterhood is very old.
Right.
My friend said, Stephen, don't take it personally, but they're like 70 years old on average. And for most of them, they simply have never yet had their first experience reading a digital book. And so they turned me down.
I would actually have loved to have just heard the conversation about that. What? You're kidding me? You can't even pick it up. You can't turn the page. I'm just imagining this whole conversation would have been very interesting.
Yeah, well, all I did is utter one big fat, oi.
Oi. Yeah, but, you know, here we go. It's the new order. It's not the old order. We're sort of in that in between place. Now, I wanted to ask you just not that you have anything at all to do with this, but you know, there's a lot going on in this world of the e-books. There's this big agita going on with Amazon and the publishing company like Hachette. Do you have any insight into that stuff?
It's a good question, and I do. And the reason I do is that my publisher is closely connected with Amazon.
Okay.
And so we often talk about, you know, what's going on. I think I should probably give a little background for our listeners who you know, just are not really prepared to understand, you know, how there came to be a suit between the publishers and Amazon.
Right.
To begin with, as I alluded to earlier, e-books themselves are not a new thing. They've been mm-hmm. around for the better part of like 30 years. But quite frankly, the early ones were mostly clumsy PDFs. They were flat. They were static. They offered virtually no technological interaction with the reader. What made them special for their day was that they could be emailed directly to a person, and that person mm-hmm. would read on their computer.
Right.
But that was the good news and the bad news. You had to read a PDF, you know, on a computer. And in the early days, 20, 30 years ago, this was largely before the big boom even with laptops. So when I say computer, the audience should be picturing just a big, fat-ass desktop computer.
Sure.
And so that's how you read the e-books. The only other choice to read a book, if it were published only in that kind of format, would in fact be to print the book out. You could print out from most of the PDFs, but of course you would have been exhausting about 9 expensive cartridges of printer ink, mm-hmm. which would have defeated the purpose of buying the less expensive ebook in the first place.
Sure.
Anyway, you know, ebooks, nobody was buying them. They weren't a booming business. There was like a no business at all. Publishers produced, you know, very few of them mm-hmm. for the simple reason there was no market for them. And in fact, in those days, there was no Amazon. Amazon wasn't even formed until 1994. That's pretty recently, actually.
Okay.
And in those early days, Amazon was not selling a whole lot of e-books either. They barely existed. Like I said, no market for them. But how shall I put this? Amazon was smart. Amazon was Prometheus smart, seeing the writing on the wall smart.
Right.
They foresaw how the digital age would affect publishers. And they helped to create a market for digital books. Okay? They were the forerunner. And I'm referring, when I say this, to all the R&D that went into developing the first successful digital reader, the Kindle, because the Kindle was an absolute game changer. This just was the preview to the future of reading. And because the Kindle was interactive to a degree, it had instant downloads, suddenly ebooks went from being a clumsy PDF, they became a kind of practical alternative to the traditional book. And that was a really, really, big thing, an absolute
right.
game changer. Now, the thing is, the publishing company or publishing companies, they could have invented this. They might have had the foresight, but they didn't. And you have to
mm-hmm.
keep that in mind.
Yes.
Amazon invented this, in effect, four of the publishing companies. Amazon spent millions of its own R&D dollars to produce the Kindle, okay, which mm-hmm. went a long way to creating the market. Well, the thing is, as most of us know, you know, when the Kindle finally, you know, got its sea legs, some people would say it began a tragic cycle. You know,
okay.
E-books were coming exponentially more popular. And as that was happening, you know, paper-bound sales were circling the drain. That's a little bit of a hyperbolic statement.
Yes.
But as of about 3 years ago, e-books have been outselling paperbacks and hard, and the divide between the two is fairly substantial at this point. And as you probably know, you know, as the years went by, all the big bookstore chains went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
No more Borders, no more all these other stores, and only Barnes & Noble remains.
Right.
And Barnes & Noble is reputed to be tottering into bankruptcy. Anyway, so now we're with that, we're kind of a little bit better able to understand the battle between Amazon and Hachette. When I first published, Amazon was, I don't know how else to say it, they were kind of greedy bastards because they could be. They were the only
right.
game in town. And for every book that Amazon sold, and this wasn't just for me, it was for all of their books, Amazon, all of their digital books anyway, Amazon took 70% and left the rest for the publisher and the right to divide, however their contract stipulated. Well, eventually, you know, publishers were getting really, really pissed at this. How else
sure.
to put it? Amazon was taking a huge bite of their pie. Well, it eventually came to pass that Apple decided that they were going to get into the market. And I think it was back in 2010, really early in the year, possibly even in January, Apple launched the first iPad, which mm-hmm. was the first tablet. At the same time, some people forget, it launched its iBooks. And iBooks was meant to be a big head-to-head competitor with Amazon. And so a lot of publishers said, well, screw 70% with Amazon. Let's see if we can work out a deal with Apple. Now, mm-hmm. it's one thing when you work out a deal, and there's another thing if you conspire to fix prices.
Right.
And this is the crux of the argument. It appears that any number of publishers in their battle to oppose Amazon colluded with each other to fix mm-hmm. prices through the venue of iBooks. That's what this suit is all about. The fact that it's Hachette is only because of all the companies that have been named, Hachette is the first up in terms of a court suit.
Well, I'm really speaking of the business of Amazon now doing this thing where they're holding up books from Hachette authors. They're saying, no, they're out of stock. They won't be in for weeks, and discouraging consumers from buying those books because of this disagreement. That's really
yeah,
what I'm asking about.
They're playing absolute, you know, hardball.
Yeah.
You know, they point fingers at Hachette saying that they did illegal things against Amazon. So Amazon's, quite frankly, you know, it appears that they're spitting in their face a little bit. And it will all be resolved, I suppose, in the court of law.
Okay. Fair enough. So I want to get to talking about a couple of things, really. And we're talking about some of your influences, but another influence I wanted to ask you about is, growing up in the Bronx, does being a Bronx boy, had that have any influence on you as a writer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I am absolutely a Bronx boy. My story is not exactly a Horatio Alger story, mm-hmm. but my origins are pretty humble and common. I was born in the South Bronx, actually on Southern Boulevard, a small apartment building. I suppose you would call it a tenement nowadays.
Right.
And when I was about 5 years old, we moved. The neighborhood had begun to change, which I'm sure you will recognize as a euphemism.
Yes.
There had been an influx of people of color.
Yes.
So in some cases, there was white flight, and mm-hmm. people went to the suburbs. In the case of the Bronx, you went from the South Bronx to the North or the West Bronx, or you moved to Queens. We actually moved to a small street that intersected the Grand Concourse, a little north of Kingsbridge Road, and this was my life.
Yeah.
This was my neighborhood, and it was as motivating and dramatic a setting to me as the little southern town was to Harper Lee.
Mm-hmm.
This was my domain. My particular neighborhood was just a few blocks away from the Edgar Allan Poe cottage.
Oh yeah, I've passed that on the bike last year.
Yeah, on the concourse. In fact, my public school, PS 46, was known as the Edgar Allan Poe School.
Mm.
But I love the Bronx. I really did. I love the Bronx Zoo. I love the Botanical Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
I love going to Yankee Stadium with my father. I went to Hebrew school in the Bronx. I was bar mitzvah in the Bronx. I went to DeWitt Clinton High School. But as I told you, I didn't go to college there. My father had a factory job, and it was planning to move to Queens. So I applied to and got into Queens College, and that experience changed my life as well.
What did your father do in the factory?
My father was a polisher. He worked facing a steel lathe, and he would have tubes of gold. And you would slice these tubes of gold into, different, thicknesses. And he would grind the insides of that pipe, which was the cross-section of a pipe. It's rough inside.
Mm-hmm.
And he would grind it down, and he would start making a band out of it. He would apply different finishes, different designs. That was his specialty. One of my, I always had this love of words. One of my first big words I learned from my father, who was a polisher, but he mm-hmm. loved to call himself a lapidary.
A lapidary.
That's
great.
So somebody who works with the, jewels, gemstones. So
yes.
Growing up, my father would give me a little elbow in the side, a little wink. He'd say to people, "I'm a lapidary."
Wow. Now, by sheer coincidence, no doubt, David Grossman's father had the same job as your father.
Yeah, you see, I don't know how that happened.
I don't know how that happened. Now, because one of the things you said earlier in this conversation, I've been thinking, is Stephen J. Griffel and David Grossman one and the same after reading this book? And one of the things you said earlier in this conversation said, let me think, there's no way that could be you, because you said you were good in baseball. I'm listening very closely here, young man. And David Grossman was a self-described spaz who could not deal with a ball whatsoever. So that's where the similarity ends, folks.
I don't know if you remember these old
commercials for the guy from. What's that science fiction serial, Buster Crabbe?
Sure.
The guy, that actor, and he did these T-shirt commercials in the early 70s for this T-shirt that would let you look really fit. And it looks like an ordinary T-shirt,
now.
Folks, but that's where the similarity, that's where the similarity ends. It's always stuck in my head. So you and David Grossman, you clearly have, I mean, your dad said the same job, but you were good in baseball. So I want to hear about, like, where did this character come from? Who is this kid? Or man?
David Grossman is certainly my, David Grossman is certainly my fictional alter ego.
Okay.
I think I pretty much have to own up to that.
Okay.
We share many points of biography and personality, but we absolutely are not the same.
Okay.
In fact, I use David to explore some roads that I am not likely to take.
Right.
Okay. He shows more daring than I do. Sometimes he makes dangerous choices. But by exploring his motivations and developing the consequences of his actions and relationships, I learn a great deal about myself. So David Grossman is a parallel world for me. Mm. Now, sometimes I do admit I cut it really close to reality. My sister laughs when I say, no, we're not the same. And she points to one of the novels. She'll say, David's parents are named Bill and Esther. Your parents were named Bill and Esther. You
Oops.
Couldn't even change the name? But you know, but we are different. And case in point, my sister. Now, you just read Grandview.
Yes.
And so you will certainly remember that David Grossman is an only child.
Mm-hmm.
There is no sister. Now, what most people don't know about, you know, my career, even those people who have, you know, read all my books, is that Grandview, which is the most recently published book, was actually the first one of the series that was written. And it was written about 20 or 25 years ago. And the reason why it wasn't published was very simple. I couldn't find a publisher.
Yes.
I was turned down by, one, two, three, four, 70, you know, different publishers or so.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, most of them, at least the ones that deigned to give me an actual response for their decision, said the same thing to me. And what they said is the market is absolutely glutted with first-person coming-of-age novels.
Mm.
I had not even thought about this, but apparently almost every writer, his or her first novel is a first-person coming-of-age novel. And so it was a really hard sell. And furthermore, in my case, the protagonists of Grandview are fairly young teenagers, right around 14 years old, and for the most part dominated by boy teenagers.
Right.
And so the publishers were telling me, they'd say, Mr. Griffel, point in fact is women tend to buy more books, much more books, than many more books than men do. They buy about over 70% of the trade fiction, and they probably will not want to read about 14-year-old boys. And so everyone passed on Grandview. And it wasn't until 20 years later where a publisher that I had sent 40 years later to absolutely fell in love with it and published it. About a year or two later, I had written a book called The Deadline, and my publisher loved that book, too. Those books also feature David Grossman, but they feature David Grossman as not only grown, but a middle-aged guy in his 50s or 60s.
Right.
So to answer your question, David and I are kind of welded at the hip.
Okay. But yet we've never seen you two at the same time.
Yeah, and you never will.
Never will. Now, I have to ask you, because one of the things that, this book, for anybody listening, is, you know, takes place in the Catskills, summer cottages, and it's a lot like camp. basically. It's like the camp within the cottages. I definitely harken back to one of my favorite books from childhood, The City Boy. Was that an influence on you at all?
No, The City Boy was not an influence, but you know, the Grandview, the action of Grandview takes place during one particular summer,
yes,
right around the year 1960 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit later, maybe the early 60s perhaps. Now, in fact, I spent 10 years living in the Catskills, or
mm-hmm.
what is called among my tribesmen and women, the Jewish Catskills, because it's very different from the other Catskills. It has its own coloration,
right,
and history and culture for sure. But those events of those 10 summers spent up there absolutely influenced my personality, my absolute life. In fact, I think it's fair to say that I was born and raised in the Bronx, but the Catskills is where I grew up. The Catskills, I mean, this is where I spent my wonder years, you know, all of those formative summers,
mm-hmm.
from ages 8 to 17.
And you were there at the same time as that, you know, the movie Dirty Dancing takes place.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. There's someone, the screenwriter, who wrote the movie A Walk on the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
In one of her interviews, she goes on at some considerable length to kind of, you know, describe that particular film, because anyone who is Jewish who watched that film knows that it takes place in a Jewish resort with Jewish waiters and Jewish,
yes,
owners, etc. But the movie studiously never mentions the word Jew.
Right.
And that was, you can be absolutely sure that was quite intentional. They were going for a very, you know, mainstream audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Jew story, you know, simply wasn't going to play.
But they remember the other movie, The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz? Which
by Mordecai Rickler.
Yeah.
Yes, Richard Dreyfuss played that role.
Richard Dreyfuss, but that was his start. That was his breakout vehicle.
Yes. That also, I had seen that and loved it, but also not a big motivating factor for me. For me, it was really that all of those kind of landmark events in my life, I always associated with my summers in the Catskills.
Mm.
I mean, that's where I learned to swim. That's where I learned to catch a ball. That's where I kissed a girl for the very first time.
Mm.
All those big firsts were growing up in the Catskills. And so it was not surprising for me that one day, when I was going to write my first book, I set it in the Jewish Catskills. Now, because I needed to have a strong narrative, it just wasn't a string of pearls stretching across 10 years.
Right.
I took those stories that were most meaningful to me and shaped them as organically as I could into some subplots that all worked together during the course of one single summer, and that is the narrative shape of Grandview.
So what stories, could you give me a couple of stories that were pretty much the same story in real life that I would have read in Grandview, or characters even?
I'll give you one, and I'll show you how it's similar and how it's different.
Sure.
The men of Grandview,
yes,
did have a men's softball team.
Mm-hmm.
And during one particular summer, they were terrific.
Yeah.
Every Sunday, they would play a team from a different bungalow colony, and sometimes even from the major hotels. And they were absolutely terrific, and they had, I think, an absolute perfect season. one summer.
Right.
And it was very exciting. In my novel, I start with that premise.
Yes.
And as you know, I don't want to give too much away. I take it to almost superhuman length.
Right.
By creating an adversary that was really extraordinary. Now, that adversary, by the way, has his parallel in real life. I'm not sure that you're aware of.
Yeah, that. I was going to ask you about that. The what do you call him, the king?
Well, yes. In real life, there was a man named Eddie Fainter.
Yes, yes.
And he was famous for being the headliner of a softball troupe
mm-hmm.
called The King and His Court.
Yes, I remember that.
He was just the greatest pitcher who ever lived, and he only played with, I think, one infielder, maybe a shortstop, a first baseman, a catcher, and maybe one outfielder. So that's all they played with four other players. So there were like five players on the team, and they were unbeatable because Eddie Fainter was an absolute Paul Bunyan magician with the softball.
Right.
And so I created a character based on Eddie Fainter, and I had that character oppose my father and all of the other fathers of Grandview into the ultimate softball.
No, that was great stuff. And I'm going, isn't it that guy? But I couldn't quite remember the name. And I'm going, I know that's not the right name, but it sounds like that guy that I used to. I remember him coming on, I don't know if it was Johnny Carson or some show of that nature, and then showing the pitches, and I think he even played some demonstrations against major league players who couldn't hit him either.
Oh yeah, he was famous for striking out Mays and McCovey and all of those Hall of Famer greats. Now, he was extraordinary. He could pitch blindfolded, behind his back, between his legs. He could stand in center field and throw a windmill fastball to home plate and throw it for a strike time after time after time.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was just amazing. So there were many, many Grandview stories.
And what about the female characters? Because there was this attractive. I've imagined them in my mind, each attractive young women, and the one that you have the big crush on, or I mean, not you, David. Excuse me, David has
yes,
a big crush.
Thank you very much for that. I get in enough trouble.
Yes.
In fact, I said that I spent 10 summers in the Catskills.
Yes.
Eight of them were spent at a bungalow colony called Grandview. What a surprise there. But the last 2 years were spent at a bungalow colony in Mountaindale, New York, different area of the Catskills.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the unusual name of Dr. Locker's Bungalow Colony. And it was during my two summers there that I had an enormous crush on a beautiful teenage girl named Andrea Cohen.
Hmm.
She's transformed into Andrea Cooper in this novel. But this did not take place. I mean, in the book, of course, it all takes place in Grandview. But this is yet another example of me importing a motivation from outside of Grandview, strictly speaking, and putting it into that one summer of events.
Okay. By the way, is Andrea Cohen aware of this character? Have you ever contacted her?
I once ran into her. It had been, 35 years, maybe close to 40 years
mm-hmm.
after having seen her. And it was at a time, this was before any of my novels were published. And I told her that I had written a novel and that she was pretty much the female lead, the inspiration for the female lead. Well, she walked four steps away from me.
Okay.
As fast as you can imagine. I think she thought that I was a stalker.
Oh.
That I had been somehow obsessed with her. And I really wasn't, not at all.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with the story of that, her and what she did mean to me, and I built a storyline around that relationship using David Grossman and a fictionalized Andrea Cooper.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I guess she won't be coming to the, you know, the movie premiere.
I guess not. I have, you know, I hope Steven Spielberg picks this up.
He should. I want to play one of the. I want to play one of the people in the. One of the dads, I think.
You know, maybe. You know, maybe you will. My publisher's probably going to be really angry about this.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't like when I say something about my work that isn't actually written stone, but since I started, I'm going to go through with it.
Sure.
I have tentative plans to actually interview Nancy Spielberg.
Wow.
For Stay Thirsty magazine.
Okay.
And it's slated to happen in January or February. Now, being in my position, you, I'm sure, can imagine where my fantasies went with this.
Yes.
So when I said that I'm hoping that Spielberg picks it up, I don't say that I have one foot in the door, or if I do, I have it only in one imaginative foot, in an imagined door.
Yeah, I can hear now. Steven will love this book.
Yeah, right, as they say, from her mouth to God's ears.
Why not? So it sounds great. Now, and believe it or not, we're in our final 5 minutes here on Coach's Corner. Actually, 3 minutes. Wow, time has flown.
Boy, it really was a fast hour, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was a fast hour. So now is a good time to say, is there anything else you want to add that I haven't asked you? And also to let people know exactly how they can catch a copy of your books.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. The easiest way to buy the books is very simply just go to Amazon.com and just write in my name, Stephen J. Griffel, and all, you know, three novels will pop up. People are always asking me in what order they should read them. And I'm always suggesting that even though Grandview was the one that was published most recently, it is, chronologically speaking, the beginning of the David Grossman story.
Yes.
So I do suggest to readers that they begin with Grandview and then move on to 40 Years Later and then to The Deadline.
Okay. I'm definitely on that track, as I have already read Grandview, and I'm definitely like to know Mr. Grossman as an adult now.
Yeah, he's still up to a lot of hijinks. No surprise there, I suppose.
Okay, that sounds good. And I do have a link in the show page, so anybody who has come through Blog Talk Radio will see in the introduction a link to the Amazon page that has you there.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. So I just want to say it's been really great to have you on Coach's Corner on my first show in a year.
Honored. Thank you.
So so once again, thank you for being on my show. I want to thank anyone who is listening live today, which is July 15th of – is it the 15th or the 14th?
15th, I think.
Okay, July 15th, 2014. And if you're not listening on that date, you're listening on a podcast. Thanks for downloading. And we'll be back soon here on Coach's Corner. You can find out about me, Andrew Poritz, at myfuturecoach.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Coach Andrew. And if you'd like to hear me sing, you can find me on Vimeo, vimeo.com, at Coach Andrew. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon. Good night.